Three, two, one. Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo. Jeremy Goldcorn will be back next week. So the Capital Literary Festival at Capital M at Tianmen here in Beijing came to a successful conclusion this past weekend, and we'll be making more of those sessions available in coming weeks. But this week, we're delighted to have Tom Carter, Shanghai-based photographer and editor of the just-released book Unsavory Elements, which is a collection of nonfiction writing from expatriates living or formerly living here in China. So Tom and some of the contributors to the book spoke on a panel at the Literary Festival this past weekend, and Tom's been gracious enough to join us here on Seneca. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much, Kaiser.
I'm also pleased to welcome an old friend, Graham Earnshaw, who not only contributed to the collection, but through the auspices of his company, Earnshaw Press, published it as well. Graham has been in China for longer than just about any other expatriate I know. I think you go back to the early mid-80s, is that right?
The Ming Dynasty, actually.
Right, Kaiser. Ming Dynasty, yeah. So 1368 to 1644. And well-preserved old man. That's very good. So he and I actually go back a long way. Graham, so glad to finally have you on Seneca.
Absolutely, Kaiser. Great to be here.
So, Tom, let's start, just jump right in and talk a little bit about yourself, your time in China, and your first book, The Book of Photography, China, Portrait of a People. How did you decide to go from a book of portraits of Chinese people to a book of personal stories from Anglophone expats? But first, you know, a little bit about you. You got here in what, 2005?
I arrived in February 2004.
Oh, 04, okay.
I had responded to an ad on Craigslist that turned out to be a scam.
Oh, wow.
So I found myself lost in translation. And it was through a classified ad in the That's Beijing that I found another job and decided to stick it out. That took me to Shandong province and then from there back up to Beijing.
Okay. Okay. So you've been in Shanghai now for quite some years, though, no?
This is my first year.
Oh, your first year down there.
Right. Okay. Okay. Kind of all over the place.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the book of photography. You are a photographer by training? Is that right?
No, sir. I am a photographer purely by accident. It's just something I enjoy doing. And having traveled across all of China, I was taking pictures for fun.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of those 2 years, basically I had amassed this vast collection of photos that everyone encouraged me to publish into a book. So I listened to them and did it. And the rest is, literary history.
So the book, how's it fared? I mean, has it done pretty well? I mean, I hear quite a bit about it.
I think that there is a market for it because there's a lot of people who are curious about China, of course, and those are, the ones who like to read about it, and they're the ones who are more interested in it visually. So I'm covering the visual end of that interest.
And is this your first push into editorial, though?
Yes, sir. The Unsavory Elements was pretty much a result of my failure in photography, failure to turn it into a bankable career.
This is what's great about China. It's just you can reinvent yourself at every turn. Huh?
I do that a lot.
Okay. So in this current incarnation, though, I mean, you sure have rounded up quite a roster of writers. There's some really big names in this book.
Yes, that came from my love of literature and me wanting to reach out to all of my favorite China authors and just bring them all together to collaborate on a project.
Yeah. So tell us a bit. I mean, how did you? I mean, you swung some pretty big. I mean, Peter Hessler, Michael Meyer, Deb Fallows. I could go
Simon
on.
Simon Winchester.
Simon Winchester wrote the epilogue. Yeah. I mean, my God. And that's a really really good piece of writing. Simon's it's a very very good epilogue. How did you? I mean, how was the reception? Did you offer them, huge piles of money, or
yeah, all my teaching salary? They all happened to be really cool people and were accessible and enthusiastic about my idea. I didn't know any of them personally.
Wow!
I just contacted them as a fan of their books and said, "Hey, I'd like to read something more. So, how about I commission something original from you?" And let's all put it together into a book. And it was just kind of a grassroots project that we all decided to do together.
And before you reached out, had you already talked to Graham and lined up a publisher? Had he already talked to you, Graham?
I'm not quite sure at what point in Tom's process he contacted me, but it was I think pretty early on, and we talked a bit about it in theory as to how it would work and the process. But it was Tom who contacted them, and Tom put it together.
Yeah, I was actually on your list, but the muse stubbornly refused to alight. Actually, my co-host Jeremy Goldcorn was also on your list. And both of us regrettably were not able to summon something. I couldn't reach way up into my bowels and nothing would come. It was terrible. Let me play devil's advocate for just a second here. And please take no offense to this. But at first blush, you know, there might be something to a certain kind of reader that might be off-putting about a book like Unsavory Elements. I mean, you've found that there's definitely a kind of expatriate writing, travel writing that casts the foreigner in the sort of role of the hero all the time, where Chinese characters become kind of two-dimensional props and they're not fleshed out at all, where there's this sort of exoticization going on, where China just becomes this sort of land of weirdness where, you know, bizarre things befall you all the time. I mean, were a book to be described to me kind of in those terms, I would kind of turn off to it. I would think, you know, do we really need another book of a bunch of expats talking about, oh, China is so weird, man? What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that we are the weird ones. So that's the reversal of roles.
Okay. And there's some weirdness, definitely some weirdness, but there are also kind of moments of the, you know, real sentimentality. I'm thinking now of Simon's chapter at the very end. Certainly, I think, would leave a good taste in your mouth, even if you did come to it with a kind of cynical attitude. Graham, what was your first impression when you first got hold of this as publisher to read this collection?
I was impressed by the idea and by the collection of people that was put together. I was skeptical about whether or not many of them would be willing to provide something to this, mm-hmm. Because the amount of money that's going to emerge for any individual is almost minuscule, probably enough for a Coca-Cola on a Friday night, and that's pretty much it. And so people were doing it for another reason. They were doing it in order to participate, and they were willing to, and I thought that was just wonderful. In terms of why they did it, you know, and it's what the significance of it was, I think that to address the point that you were just making, I would say that they were looking at it maybe subconsciously from the perspective of what is the foreigner experience in China, what is there that is special about that? Because foreigners, i.e., the word foreigners itself is a bit weird in mm-hmm. that it's a sort of a negative thing of being not Chinese, but I think there's something which is uniform about the way that foreigners, that is, people who grew up in Western society and culture, how they react to Chinese culture and Chinese society, which it spans the decades as well. In other words, the kind of experiences that are described in this book are very similar to the kinds of experiences that foreigners had in the 20s and the 30s and the 19th century.
That's actually something that you wrote, didn't you? In your intro, Tom, you said something like, change is the only constant in China, yet the more China changes, the more it stays the same, and our experiences as outsiders remain essentially timeless. I'm not sure the extent to which I would agree with that. I mean, there's certainly I get where that's coming from, but I mean the experience I know that, you know, I had coming here in the 1980s and then, you know, living here more or less from 96 on, if you were to take me out, if I had, you know, come here only last year, I'm sure my experience would have been completely different. In fact, I mean, I don't, you know, when I started reading some of the essays in this, I felt like maybe I wouldn't have been able to write such a thing. I mean, maybe I don't feel foreign enough here. I feel like I'm not treated all that much as a foreigner here. I mean, there's nothing, I wouldn't be able to share in that alienating experience. I mean, and I would have maybe written something that was...
Well, you're not exactly a typical foreigner.
No, I'm definitely not. But I mean, I talked to Jeremy about this, and he sort of felt the same way. But of course, he has been here for an awfully long time, right. He, like me, married to a Chinese woman and speaks very good Chinese. Right. In any case, let's talk about some of the stories in here that really stood out to the both of you. If each of you could maybe pick one or two that you think are kind of emblematic, you know, that really characterize or are, you know, just
outstanding pieces of writing that you want to flag for the person to start off with? Tom?
Sure. Well, for me, as the editor, I was kind of a hawk about the prose because I'm just an old school fan of classical literature. And I was really diligent to make sure that there was a kind of lyrical and almost poetic prose to everyone's writing as opposed to something that you would read in a magazine, travel article, or on a blog. I wanted this to really be as close to literature as possible. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the stories were not supposed to just be entertaining, but well-written as well. And so of the writing talent that is participating in this anthology, we have a core group of established writers as well as some new aspiring talent. And for me, it was kind of a bit of pride to bring out the writing of this aspiring writers who are based here in China and just kind of nurture their topics into creating these short stories for the book.
Well, let's talk about who some of these people are, what their backgrounds are, and what they contributed.
Sure. Well, there's a gentleman by the name of Matt Muller who's based in Chengdu, and he is an English teacher just like I am and, you know, deals with the day-to-day standing in front of the classroom stuff that I've dealt with since I arrived here in 2004. And I didn't want him to just write another teaching article. What I wanted him to do is kind of turn it into a piece of poetry where he is exasperated by his career, because that is a feeling we all feel at some point as English teachers in China. But to have fun with it prose-wise and just turn it into a playful piece of writing, and he pulls it off. I really feel that for a first-time writer, it is a beautiful piece of writing.
And you felt like you didn't have to massage it too much?
I nurtured everyone's topics, but, you know, it's a collaborative effort. Editing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a middle ground that you find. I have a vision about the book, but I didn't want to interfere too much in their actual writing. What I wanted was the book to have a kind of thematic progression from beginning to end. And in that sense, all the stories needed some kind of continuity. They needed to share something. So that was my responsibility. Their responsibility was just to write really good.
Write really well. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
I felt I had to get that. So what was the logic behind, say, starting with Alan Paul's piece on the family trip in Sichuan?
Sure. Alan Paul's an established writer.
But yeah, right.
What
Big
I
in
wanted,
China.
And, right. Exactly, and his blog with Wall Street Journal.
Right.
But what I wanted from him was just a kick-ass road trip story because we've all had those.
Yeah.
And he had one that he hadn't really shared in his past writing, and he wanted to finally write that piece that he hadn't been able to before.
National Lampoon's Sichuan Vacation.
Right? Exactly.
Right. Your turn, Graham. What was there an outstanding essay that you thought, I mean, was there one that really grabbed you?
I think the telling of stories is the opportunity that was provided by this book. And Matthew Polly, a writer who spent 2 years at Shaolin Monastery in Henan Province.
Right.
And he tells it with great humor and aplomb.
Yeah, and it's self-effacement.
Absolutely, yeah. It's wonderful. And that for me was the pinnacle of the book. I thought it was wonderful.
That was a good piece, though. And I thought that I would zero in on that one and find that, you know, the humble brag going on, but I found it kind of, you know, free of that kind of straw man criticism that I had drummed up just now.
This is why I call them, the two Matts, I call them son number one and son number two, because they both really, you know, bookend the book.
Okay. Any other standouts for you, Graham?
Well, Simon Winchester is just a wonderful writer.
He really is.
In the traditional way, and his epilogue piece, never before published, was wonderful. It was a great way to round it out, and was from a strictly writing perspective, I think he's probably the best in there.
Yeah, I think he seizes on a couple of excellent little sort of, you know, microcosmic vehicles to kind of give you a sense of the sweep of change that is taking over. I mean, just for anyone who hasn't yet read the book, is it available now? You can Kindle it, or
it's going to be up on Amazon very soon.
Okay,
it's available in bookstores in Shanghai. It's available from Earnshaw Books in Shanghai, and if you go to the earnshawbooks.com website, you'll be able to contact us and get it.
Great. I got myself a PDF copy of it, but
just don't distribute.
Not be sharing that with anybody. No, don't you worry. So, Tom, you talk about the whole thing sort of having an arc, like a sort of a meta continuity to it. Can you kind of give a sense for what that's all about? How you saw the arc from Alan's to Simon's piece?
Sure. It kind of parallels with my own experience here, where I arrive in China and I'm kind of lost in translation, to use a cliche, but it is a very profound cliche, and just not knowing what I want to do here or how I want to pursue my career path or lack of one here, and just kind of wandering from province to province, you know, teaching and getting into freelancing gigs.
Like then, Confucius, right? Wandering from province to province, freelance teaching.
Or Kane in Kung Fu.
Right. yes, grasshopper.
I am the grasshopper, and I'm hopping from province to province, which is what I did during my two-year travels across all of China. Mm-hmm. But during those 2 years is when I really grew as a person and also as someone who was discovering Chinese culture for the very first time. So by the end of that journey, I had pretty much absorbed and just been immersed in the society so long that I felt I had a pretty well-rounded idea of what this country was about. And that is when I realized that I had inadvertently fallen in love with the country, because I did definitely not come here with that intention. I came here just because I wanted to travel and go on adventures. Mm-hmm. But now it is my home. I've married into the culture, and I didn't see that coming ever. So I wanted the book to try to just capture what I had personally experienced, where we're here and we're kind of lost and we're going on fun adventures and we're doing cool things. But, you know, at the same time, we have the ups and we have the downs and we have the good days and the bad days, the suan tian ku la. Uh-huh. And I wanted to just capture all of those emotions and all of those experiences to make it a kind of the ultimate, the definitive, well-rounded expat experience in China.
Okay. Are there other countries that you can think of where such a book needs to be written? I mean, I don't know other expat communities, but surely, you know, there are a bunch of people in Russia conspiring to write such a thing, or in India, or say the expatriate experience in Brazil, or even in not so far away from the U.S. in Mexico. What is it also? I mean, these are all Anglophone expats. I mean, that was a deliberate choice of yours, obviously, because the language was going to be English. But that is itself a particular vantage point because of the sort of the historical legacy that you are coming down to China, in a sense, coming from a more developed country to a less developed country. Does that carry with it any kind of taint of imperialism? Is there, and this is always something to watch for in writing like this. I mean, and the reason I raise this, you know, that wasn't present in, say, the Americans in Paris in the early 20th century. There wasn't this sense of our own superiority as a civilization somehow. There was this humility before it. I don't know that most of the expat writing that I read in China has that same sense of humility. How do you feel about how the authors came off on that regard, Graham?
I think one of the factors that may be influencing you, Kaiser, in this, or may be influencing the situation, is that the difference between China and the other countries that you just mentioned in terms of the nature, the situation of foreigners here, is that China is exceptional because there was a period of 30, 40 years when there were no foreigners in China. Mm-hmm. And so there was no continuity of the foreigner experience in China as there was in Brazil and I think to some extent even in Russia, but not in China. And then suddenly they piled in some in the 70s, you know, like myself, and then others in the 80s like you. And then they created something which was, to a very large extent, and to some extent, not as much now, but definitely in the early phases of this, was very strictly kept separate from the Chinese world around us. And so that, I think, bred an attitude which, in some senses, is not necessarily one that we could be proud of. But I think there is a reason for it, which is why China is different from, say, Americans in Paris.
I think that's very well observed. Yeah, there is that period of total discontinuity. Really.
None, right. They threw all the foreigners out.
Right. That's interesting. I hadn't really, I mean, it hadn't entered my thinking on this. If you were to step back from this book and sort of imagine yourself as someone who had never been to China, and this is the first piece of writing they're encountering, what do you think is the China that emerges from this picture, Tom?
A China of change. All the stories that take place in this anthology have taken place during this, you know, the past decade or two decades, which has been China's greatest period of change. So there is that progress and development in motion that is, you know, observed in everyone's writings, whether it's, you know, consciously or unconsciously, but it exists in their writings. For example, Alan Paul's road trip across Sichuan. Yeah, he's going on a travel adventure in Sichuan, but it is disrupted because the highways are right in the middle of this massive, you know, construction project. Mm-hmm. And his whole trip gets derailed because of this construction. That construction wasn't happening a decade ago, but it is everywhere now, much to our discomfort.
Right. Interesting. So China of change. What about the impression of the Chinese that would come out of a book like this? How do the Chinese characters come off in this?
I think that it is a bit timeless in that regard, because outside of the cities, there are villages to be found that have not changed in, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years, and life goes on. You know, the farming villages, the rural life. In that regard, that part of China is timeless. And, you know, Graham, who's been walking across China and has, you know, firsthand seen how the countryside really contrasts with the big cities, I think can speak even to better authority than I
would. Would you agree with that, Graham, that there's this timeless quality to the village life? I'm always impressed on the other side. I go back to, you know, the ancestral home, and I'm sort of overwhelmed by the mental change, not so much the infrastructural or the physical change.
Oh, many things changed, of course. The degree of change, even in the most remote provinces and villages, is extraordinary. And the satellite television and mobile phones and the whole migrant worker phenomenon, which mm-hmm. means that people now have an understanding about the outside world that they didn't before. All these things have changed. But there is still something that is timelessly solid, in which even the 1960s, which was and 70s, which was in its way just as disruptive of traditional sure. China as all the economic development, that even that didn't manage to break, which was the family. The sense of cohesion of a Chinese family is still something that's very strong, even when you've got the members scattered over, you know, Zhuhai and Ningbo. Mm-hmm. They still come back together at Chinese New Year. There is that sense of cohesion, which I think has survived all of these decades, and which is still superior to the kind of cohesion that you find in many Western countries.
Well, that's great. I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of what's in there. While I've got Graham in here, though, I really want to talk a little bit more about the whole enterprise of sure. Earnshaw Books, of Earnshaw Press. You've published a number of quite diverse books, everything from a book by my friend John Campbell about mm-hmm. It's called Red Rocks, Red Rock. The Long Strange mm-hmm. March of Chinese Rock and Roll,
yeah.
to reminiscences of Edmund Backhouse, Décadence Manchu.
Yes.
Tell me what drives you to do this, and surely you're not you know growing rich on this.
Certainly not. I'm one of the authors in Unsavory Elements, and I've been asked to sign some of the books, and I've been writing in it that publishing doesn't make any money, but it can make a lot of friends,
right.
And then put my name in there. And I think that that's what it's all about nowadays. A small publishing house like this is being done by me, and I'm sure other people like me, for the fun of it, for the joy of putting together a book such as Unsavory Elements, which has a value, you know.
Absolutely.
Whether it's in paper form or digital form, I don't think particularly makes much difference. But I think books will survive this shift from paper to pixels. And the real reason I founded Earnshaw Books, I believe, was to experience it firsthand, this revolutionary shift from the Gutenberg era through to whatever it is, the Steve Jobs era.
So tell me about some of the other titles that maybe our listeners aren't so familiar with.
Well, we've done one of our best-selling books recently is Behind the Red Door, which is an overview
Richard
of the
Berger.
Situation at Richard Berger. Exactly right. The overview of sex in China.
Hey, Richard. I'm sure you're listening.
I hope he is too. And done really well. And,
yeah.
And it's
rave reviews, that one. Yeah.
Very good reviews and a delight to read. And sold well in the United States at the level of this kind of a book and where we are. Another book, our second best-selling book, is a book called The Cultural Revolution Cookbook, done by a guy named Scott Seligman and a writer friend of his. And they put together the best recipes from the villages of China and then added in with every page a story about from the Cultural Revolution.
Wow.
And it's a large, colorful thing which cost a fortune to print, but which has sold well and which has it takes it out of the normal cooking book by having this very weird symbiosis between cooking and Lin Biao.
So, I mean, is there an outstanding Huzhou recipe in there? I mean, there's got to be, right?
Definitely is. Okay. And there's all of the things. The idea was that many city people, including Scott's co-author, were sent from the cities down to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution. Right. And they learned an entirely new form of cooking. And something which
cooking
while
for
they,
the commune,
they,
right?
Right, and they were of course happy to get back to the cities when things changed. But they brought back with them a sense of that the purity and the simplicity of the cooking in those villages, and that was what it's a celebration of ordinary Chinese cooking as opposed to the stuff you get in these highfalutin pseudo nouveau Chinese restaurants in Beijing these days.
Green tea house. one more. Give me one more good plug of another Earnshaw Books publication.
Well, the book that I love still the best is Décadence Manchoue, which is a memoir by Edmund Backhouse, who was a raving homosexual who enjoyed immensely his time in Beijing and wrote a memoir about how he had intimate relations with Empress Dowager. And,
who I think sodomized him with her clitoris, with this like outsized clitoris.
Indeed. There's a lot you can argue about a lot of the facts in the book, but all the people who can deny it are now dead.
Oh, no, and it's completely non. I mean, the guy was a notorious forger and a liar.
I'm not sure. We can do a couple of hours.
So
on
no,
this.
Yeah, we could. But let me just very quickly. What was your take on Hugh Trevor Rober's book, The Hermit of Peking? Did you think he was unfair to old Backhouse?
I think he was very unfair, and I think the reason was that he felt very uncomfortable with the way that Edmund was celebrating homosexuality. And
there was Trevor that. Roper. That did rub me wrong. Right.
I think had certain proclivities in that direction, but was repressed, as so many English men of that era and even today are. And I think at the heart of it was just an absolute disgust with the way that Edmund just loved it, reveled in it,
yeah,
absolutely, and basically challenged the reader to say, "This is me. This is what I did. If you don't like it, it's your problem. It's not my problem." Good for him.
Yeah, good for him. I'd still recommend that anyone read it because it's a rollicking good read.
Oh, it's hilarious.
I've been having a great time with that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, let's move on to the segment of our show where, I mean, I think Graham can be pardoned from having to make a recommendation if you don't have one at the ready because you've already recommended so many excellent books, which I highly recommend anyone take on. But we, of course, at the end of every show, make recommendations. So why don't we start with Tom? Do you have something for us this week?
Well, mine might be a little bit different than usual recommendations, but having not been in Beijing for so long and just returned to the city literally the other day for the first time in many years and just kind of rediscovering how the city has changed and all the hutongs that have been, you know, erased forever or the ones that have been just completely commercialized like Gulo, I'm going to recommend plaster t-shirts because for me it is a bit of just the perfection in taking what is beautiful about China and being playfully creative with it and turning it into merchandise that can be enjoyed all over the world, whether you're familiar with Chinese culture or not. And I know that plastered is pretty popular in Beijing, but beyond China's borders,
I would love to be able to just walk down the street and, you know, see someone wearing a plastered shirt. So I want to give props to Dominic Johnson Hill's Plastered. Dominic contributed the cover art to Unsavory Elements, which is just a really well done, brilliant
I didn't know you had
piece
that
of art. Mm. Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, plastered T-shirts, trancotiers, they're called in Chinese. Okay, Graham, do you have one for us? Or
Nothing springs to mind, but okay, I'm sure you have something that's
great. I don't. Actually, what I want to do is re-recommend something that we touched on in passing, talking with Jeremy Barmet on the last podcast. I talked about thechinastory.org. It's a project by the Center for China in the World at the Australian National University, headed up by the inimitable Jeremy Barmet, who some of you may have heard on last week's show. And I talked about this a little bit, but you know, the sound quality wasn't good, and I just want to make sure to reiterate this. The part of the China story I really want people to focus on is called Lexicon. It's, I think, such an inspired idea. There, what Jeremy has done is he's selected some of the big third rail hot topics, the ones that really get people, you know, shouting and angry, the ones that are most sort of heatedly contested, and he lays them out. So in this nice sort of neutral, non-normative language, first laying out the CCP official narrative, then sort of narratives from dissenters within China, the opposing narratives within China, on a topic, say, like, you know, Xinjiang, or like currency valuation or something like that. And then we'll take the sort of Western academic perspective, the academic narrative, and finally the Western media narrative. And it's just such a great way to get multiple perspectives on these contested issues, and I just think it's a great service to mankind. I was encouraging him to open it into a sort of invite-only wiki, so that experts in these particular topics can go in and write, with, of course, Jeremy's editorial blessing on the top. Anyway, Graham, it was so good to have you, man.
Great to be here. Really great to talk to you.
Come back next time, and next time you're in Beijing, we've got a ton of things to talk about.
Sure.
Tom, man, it was a great pleasure meeting you, and you know, congratulations on the book, and I hope that this helps you sell some. I think a lot of our listeners would be really, really interested in reading it, and I certainly am, and looking forward to finishing the ones that I haven't gotten to. So thanks much.
Thank you, sir.
And we will see you guys all next week. Jeremy will be finally back, and I will be traveling, so he's going to take over next time. We'll talk to you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Bye-bye.